And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this edition of the Hagmann Report. It is Wednesday, December 11, 2024. I want to welcome everyone. Thank you so much for your belief and trust in this platform, in me, and of course, the guests that we have. And I've been looking forward to this all week. I really have. Pulitzer Prize winner, Congressional Medal of Honor winner. I'm just trying to think. Well, no, not really. He is just really the legendary Peter Barry Chowka is on with me. Folks, it's been such a long time. So much has gone, water under the bridge, over the bridge, across the bridge, into the bridge and back again since we've had Peter on. But, got a lot of emails actually over the last several months saying, hey, you know, where's Peter? I want to see Peter. And Peter and his cats, if you take a look at over his left shoulder to the right of the screen, you'll see one of his cats. We'll be getting in that momentarily. Before we get into the program, again, welcome everyone. Thank you. Please do me a favor. This could be like your Christmas present to me. Okay. The people listening to this on audio podcast, in audio, whatever, or whatever, please just do me one favor. All I want for Christmas is, more Rumble subscribers. Really, that's all. It's hard to believe 250,000, YouTube. They just said, hey, you know, they sent me a nice plaque saying, oh, we love you. And then they, next day, kind of like a scorned woman saying, a scorned lover, not woman, man, it could be him, saying, you know what, we think you suck, so bye, because, you know, that's just the way they are. So commie tube, no go. But we had almost a quarter of a million, this is south of a quarter of a million subscribers. So please do me a favor, go to Rumble and create an account, subscribe, follow us. Enter the chat if you want. We like it because we can see what you're thinking and what you're saying. All right. Before we get in, before we bring Peter Barry-Chowka on, my goodness, those words just, it's like I forgot how to say them. I mean, this guy's a valuable guy. I have to tell you, he is a legend. Well, we'll be getting into that more shortly, but before I go on, folks, go to don'twastepower.com. Look, this is a great Christmas idea. Here is what this looks like. This little device plugs into your wall outlet. Don'twastepower.com. Recent reports show that U.S. electricity bills have really been a 10-year record high. This past summer, now it's, look, it, even with President Trump getting in, it's not going to go down right away. Many households say, hey, we got to fight to either keep our house at safe temperatures or to attempt to lower, or unsafe temperatures to attempt to lower costs, or, you know, it's either electricity or food, right? So it's crazy how this is working. So I've been able to lower my energy bills with the help of that magical little device. Absolutely love the cost savings it gives me. Thanks to it, I can help cut down on my electricity costs, keep more money in my pocket from the power companies. It's designed to help lower my costs by stopping my home and appliances from wasting unnecessary energy, reduce my electricity usage, supports a consistent, safe flow of electricity throughout my home, and much more. Just all you have to do is plug it in and forget about it. It works. Okay. And, I find that, one works really, really, really well. Two works even more really well. And, because of the size of my house, three works really, really well. So anyway, please visit don'twastepower.com. That's don'twastepower.com, or just click on the link in the description box below. Again, great Christmas gift. Who knows? Or one for lowering your own, you know, electricity costs. All right. Peter Barry-Chowka, without any further ado, it's great to see you, my friend. How are you, sir?
Doug, it's great to see you, and it's great to talk with Eric again. I'm doing okay.
You're looking fabulous.
Well, we'll see.
you don't look a day over 35, 9, no. Something.
Well, you know, hair, makeup, and lighting can do wonders, as well as the technology. But, you know, I was thinking, it's where have the last 3.5 years gone? It was 3 years and 7 months ago, the first week of May 2021, when I was here on your platform for the last time till today.
Wait and a second. When was that date?
First week of May 2021. On that occasion, I guest hosted two of the shows back to back. The 3.5 years. Now, when I think back to that period, of course, we were still at the height of the COVID madness, the pandemic, the lockdowns, the mandates. The vaccine was out by then, so to do certain jobs or to travel, you were supposed to have that vaccine. And a lot of travel was still really prohibited unless you wanted to quarantine when you got to your destination on the East Coast, for example. But we were only 2.5 months into the Biden-Harris regime at that point, so we hadn't yet seen the full flower of their attempt to transform the country, to really wrap up and finish what Barack Obama had started in 2009 when he took office. But thank God it's a new day dawning now. But in the intervening 3.5 years, I've continued to write pretty frequently and regularly for American Thinker at AmericanThinker.com. In fact, today I have a new article there about the first interview that Mr. Denny gave after he was exonerated or found not guilty in the trial that he underwent in New York for the subway, alleged subway killing of the homeless black man. And yesterday I wrote about Pete Hegseth, President Trump's nominee for director of the Department of Defense, who gave his first interview, if you can call it that. He got 4.5 minutes to speak on Sean Hannity's show. But this was the softball of all softball interviews, but maybe we can chat about that a little bit later. In the context, of course, of President Trump's return to power, which I think is the greatest transformation in modern history. I mean, we think and we know that Obama did what he promised to do in terms of setting the stage for transforming the country. But the election this year really upended that plan big time. And it's just been amazing to sit here and watch it since then, what's gone down. And by the way, I should just mention briefly the introduction of the two feline members of the household.
I love this. Folks, pay attention. Go ahead. Go ahead.
The latest arrival here is another wrestling. They love to wrestle. The solid gray cat, the male, is Biggie. He's about 11, and he was adopted off the streets of our town when he was about 1 year old. So he's been here for a decade. And this summer, he was diagnosed with lymphatic cancer of the ear, which is a rare condition that occurs in a small number of cats, not in humans, but in cats. And the only option we could really find was to have him treated at a university veterinary medical school, which has a clinic and an oncologist. So his diagnosis was confirmed there. He had the scans, and he had 2 weeks of targeted radiation therapy to his ear that had the cancer. And in his two-month checkup recently, November 5th, Election Day, that morning he had his checkup, and he's gotten a clean bill of health so far. So you never know with cancer and the treatments, but the oncologist said the treatment could be curative, so we have hopes. Now, the younger of the two, the one who's in the frame on my left, is Lola. She arrived at age 6 weeks here. She's from a litter of 9 kittens. She was born on April 11th, I believe. So she's just about 7 months old now. And it's interesting how she arrived. A friend who...
Eight months today, correct.
Okay. So she arrived. Actually, there was a knock at the door. And a friend of ours is there, a woman who had done some cat sitting for us, and she was carrying Lola, 6 weeks old. And she handed Lola to me and said, I was told to deliver this kitten to you. And I said, well, that's news. But it took about 60 seconds. And she said, well, if you don't want to keep the cat, who is as yet unnamed, of course, I'll pick her up on Monday. This was a Friday afternoon when Lola arrived on May 25th. So it took about 60 seconds for an immediate strong bond to form. She was an irrepressible, lovable kitten right from the start. Smarter than, I've parented or co-parented 12 cats in my adult life. And some of them, number of them have been kittens to start with. Lola excelled right from the start. Feisty, incredibly intelligent, ruling the roost, you know, instantly your life changes as you have this young kitten in your midst, and it becomes like a 24-hour preoccupation. Although, even though they're very adept at caring for themselves at that young age. And Lola is now exploring a bit, possibly out of camera range, but
we got her tail.
Okay. Lola, she has the most amazing tail. It's very full, long, and thick. And unfortunately, this is not touch vision here, because she has the softest, most incredible coat. Not to put down any of the other cats, but it's like a rare fur, her coat. And she had her her surgery recently to spay her, so there won't be any issues of her going into heat again. So she seems pretty well recovered and happy from that, but she's just amazing. She's gotten into places when she wants to go somewhere, like on top of the mantle, which you'd see, there's no way she can get up there. Well, she got up there, and she got down from there, too, on her own. Just incredible. So you can't really Lola-proof the house, because she will find a way around it. So you've just got to assume that...
Peter, I've got to share this story with you. Since you're saying that, my dog, Maxwell, he's a golden retriever. He actually opens levered doors, you know, the doors with the lever. Mm-hmm. He'll jump up, grab the handle, pull it down, and I'm serious, he'll walk backwards, okay, walk into the house. Now, the only thing I haven't taught him to do is close the door, which I'm working on. So I can kind of relate to you on animals with respect to, you know, how the cats get into places. And Maxwell just needs, I could throw him the car keys, and I think he probably would take the vehicle. But anyway, yeah, they're beautiful, beautiful cats, though. My goodness.
They are really incredible. We had a cat once in the 90s, our first Russian blue, Ivana Shirpur, and we nicknamed her Itty Bitty. And she could open doors, too. She could literally jump up and turn the doorknob and open the door. It was really something to behold. But, you know, I'm not putting down dogs, because I know they are and certainly can be very smart, too, and incredible companions. But I've had just much more experience with cats in my life, and every cat is different. Everyone is unique. They all have their personalities, and they all pretty much have their ways to get what they want and control their human companions. So it really is just amazing. And just to wrap up this story with a bow, it was... the other cat who was on the scene during the 150 or so appearances and guest hostings I did on the Hagman Report back in the day between 2017 and 2021, Biggie was in the picture on many of them, as was Lulu. Lulu, unfortunately, passed away. She left us on September 30th, 2023, and that was a very incredibly sad and tragic passing, but she also was an incredibly beautiful cat with a very different kind of personality. She was aloof for much of her life, but she did come around and like to be held on occasion, especially, interestingly, during the last 6 months of her life. I really felt that I finally bonded with her pretty much totally, probably because we were both getting older. We both have our health issues, and we just were on the same wavelength. So, it took. I mean, I still haven't gotten over her passing, but having Lola and seeing life go on with a new kitten now developing into a full-grown cat is really a nice antidote when you have you know, finally enough time to heal. But this another thing I've been doing this year, 2024, I've been thinking to myself that this is my 60th anniversary of being a journalist. Now, of course, I started at a very young age when I was in high school, but you've got to start somewhere. So I was reporting for my school newspaper and my social studies classes. But that year, 1964, was an incredible period to get bitten by the political bug. It actually had gotten me a few years earlier, probably during the Cuban Missile Crisis and then the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, which I remember very, very clearly. And I knew instantly then, instinctively, that something was wrong with that picture when Lee Harvey Oswald was identified as the lone assassin. But when 1964 rolled around, I became inspired by the Republican who received the presidential nomination that year, Senator Barry Goldwater from Arizona. And he was the new quintessential conservative. His book was The Conscience of a Conservative, and he directed or redirected the Republican Party away from the Eastern establishment, which had controlled it, you know, the Rockefellers and the Country Club Republicans, as they were called. And being from the West, and at the time Arizona was really kind of a super Western Republican red state. Well, of course, he lost in a landslide to Lyndon Baines Johnson, the accidental president, and Goldwater was limited to just about a half dozen states, and that began the reign of LBJ having been elected finally instead of just taken over after Kennedy's assassination. And of course, it's amazing now to see how LBJ's reputation is trying to be retooled by the Democrats and the left. I mean, his regime resulted in the Great Society to end poverty, the war on poverty, which cost about $20 trillion with a T dollars in the years since then. And has it really eradicated poverty? Of course not. It just ballooned the federal government. He also got us into the war in Vietnam, of course, after claiming that Goldwater would be the warmonger. And it's interesting then to compare that campaign with this last one. You know, the Democrats and the left look at Trump. They say he's the one who's going to destroy democracy. He's going to mess up our foreign relations, when that's exactly what Biden did, right? And everything Trump has done since he's been elected gives the lie to how his new administration is going to pan out. But so that year I started, in fact, one of the things I've been doing lately is collecting antique cameras. So this is the camera I was using in 1964. It's an Argus Autronic, A-U-T-R-O-N-I-C, Argus. This thing weighs about 3 pounds, and it took lousy pictures. So eventually, about 1964, I was using this to photograph what I was doing then and getting my feet wet and covering politics. That year, and you'll remember this name, Doug, Bill Scranton. He was the governor of Pennsylvania in the early 60s, and he was one of these left-wing establishment Republicans from the Rockefeller School. He was the last one to try to challenge Barry Goldwater for the Republican presidential nomination. He came out of nowhere, Bill Scranton, that is, the sitting governor of Pennsylvania, challenged Goldwater and, of course, got nowhere. But he became famous overnight. So he appeared at a rally in the town next to where I grew up in Connecticut. And I had my mother drive me there for this outdoor rally. And Scranton was the first politician I ever saw close up, just literally a few feet away, because I brought a tiny portable operated tape recorder. You know, if you've seen Mission Impossible, at the beginning of each episode, they show a little tape recorder and the tape self-destructs. Well, I had a tape recorder that looked like that. It was about the size of a big hardback book. And I put the microphone on the podium where he spoke. And so I'm just right up there next to him, taking pictures with the camera and the recording, which I still have. And then the next week, I managed to get into a $100 a plate fundraising dinner for the Republican Party that was headlined by former Vice President Richard Nixon. And again, I sat only a few feet away from him because I was recording it on a plug-in reel-to-reel tape recorder that time and taking pictures. And it was just awesome as a 14-year-old kid who'd never seen a celebrity or a famous politician before. And there he was, the former vice president, a few feet away. I got his autograph. I shook his hand, recorded the speech that he gave. And also on the dais that night speaking was Prescott Bush, who was a Connecticut politician who, of course, was the father of George H.W. Bush and the grandfather of Bush the Younger. Both of them would become president, of course. And there are many conspiracy theories about Prescott Bush, but at the time, all I knew him as was a former big poobah politician of the state of Connecticut. Now, the real breakthrough for my early career, 1964, came on November 30th, 1964, when Martin Luther King came to give a speech, again, at the next town over from where I grew up. And I showed up again with a reel-to-reel tape recorder and a very short microphone cable. So the organizers who welcomed me there to record it, they said, well, you've got a short cable. Why don't you just sit behind Reverend King on the stage? So I got to sit about 10 feet away from him. And on my right were about 20 or 25 leaders of the community who were sitting up there. And as he gave his stock speech, which is his version of the I Have a Dream speech. So that was pretty awesome. Although at the time, I do very clearly remember that his appearance there at this city, at a high school auditorium, was not like the second coming, which, of course, it would be today if he could somehow come back and visit us. I mean, he was one of a number of civil rights leaders of the time, perhaps the best well-known, but coming up fast were people like Stokely Carmichael. You had Whitney Young. You had Bayard Rustin. You had others whose names I'm forgetting at the moment, but he was not walking on water yet, but unfortunately he was assassinated 3.5 years later, and that tends to allow the hagiographic reexamination of someone's career. Very similar thing happened to Cesar Chavez. My old friend Rich Pollack and I, and I think I interviewed Richard here once on the Hagman Report about 5 or 6 years ago when I was doing a segment on interviews. And Richard, like me, has bona fide conservative credentials. And he and I interviewed Cesar Chavez in Washington, D.C. in 1975 at the radio station we were contributing to at the time. And Cesar arrived just with one associate, no big deal. Well, now, after he died, there's a holiday in the state of California named for him that's a day off for the schools, the banks, and everything else in California.
Wow. These people
were like more or less normal folks. I mean, certainly exceptional, but a kind of according sainthood to them once they had passed on is really ridiculous. And of course, very good at reinforcing that is PBS, Public Broadcasting. Whenever they do a documentary on some cases, some of the most obscure people imaginable from back in those times and even since. And you would think that the world, the universe revolved around the people that they are profiling on their American Master shows or whatever. It's just something to behold. But, these were just like regular folks. But that's how I started to get involved in journalism. And I don't want to belabor this story. It could go on quite long. But
I just want to say you took one of the most iconic photographs of Richard, President Richard Nixon, at the podium. I'm trying to remember the circumstances around but
June 29th, 1972. That was just over a week after the Watergate break-in. That was a press conference, prime time, in the White House East Room. And I could get into the White House at that point because I had a Metropolitan Police DC press pass. I was a legitimate bona fide press person. And you could get into the White House on an event-by-event basis. I didn't have like a White House pass, but I was never turned down. So I went with a camera and a small recorder, and I took a bunch of photos of Nixon. And the shot where he's making a fist, I Google searched that picture about a year ago. You know, you can do that now where you upload a picture and it tells you where you can find it online.
Right.
It was used at 300 websites at that point. Of course, none of them with any credit to me. Every time I've ever used it, it's had a copyright notice on it. But, you know, that's the way it goes. It was even used in a lot of advertising. Once at Michael Savage's website, he was running an ad, or an ad was running on his site for some product or service, and it had that my picture of Richard Nixon illustrating it. I forget what the thing was now, but I thought,
people have to, folks, this man has seen more than the average person alive. I mean, he's been involved with more, he's seen more, he's done more, he's been elbow to elbow with a lot of these political figures. And, you know, Peter, I'll just say this. You know, I've seen I took a couple of surveillance photographs that I had given to a couple of people. This is like 15 years ago, that all of a sudden appeared in books, you know, without credit, of course, no credit. You know, so I know what you mean, but people have to understand where you've been. And I think this is so important for people to get reacquainted with your work. I did not mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, well, I appreciate your comments, certainly. But just to put it in the context of what I'm doing now and what I hope it brings to my work now and even before now, is that these kinds of frontline experiences covering national political events, you know, I attended several national political conventions. I traveled with candidates on occasion, in particular Senator George McGovern when he ran for president, and I was on the press plane for the last 3 weeks of the campaign, an experience that is just truly amazing. And then I got very close to Jerry Brown, who was governor of California, and in 1976 he ran for president, and I also covered his primary campaign in 1980 when he tried again, his Senate campaign in 82, and his final presidential campaign in 1992. Now, at the time, Jerry Brown was, let's say, a very interesting politician. I would compare him, like now, to, say, RFK Jr. or Tulsi Gabbard. He was a Democrat, but he was open to new ideas. At one point, he made the famous statement, "We're going to move left and right at the same time." Of course, his later career largely canceled out the earlier one, but he was in touch with some very interesting people and policies in the 70s and 80s, and he was considered an outlier in the Democrat Party even then, as was George McGovern, by the way. You know, I heard Victor Davis Hanson recently, and I have incredible respect for him, but he uses George McGovern, who ran for president in 1972 against Richard Nixon, and acts like McGovern was a Biden-type figure or one of these real empty-headed loser Democrats. Well, I didn't agree then or now with all of George McGovern's policies, but he was the peace candidate. His campaign theme was Come Home, America, which is really not that much different from Make America Great Again when you think about it. He was a PhD, a history professor, really smart. He wrote 12 books, and he wrote them himself. He used to write his own speeches. He was a really, really smart man and a very nice man. And when I reconnected with him after 29 years in 2012 in La Jolla, California, where he was giving a speech at the library there, and I hadn't seen him in 29 years, and he remembered me. He said, "Oh, I remember the last time you interviewed me in my Senate office." Sure enough, that was like in 1977 or so. And it allowed me to put into perspective how I had worked for his campaign and reported on his campaign in 1972. And, you know, what did it mean in all the years since? I mean, I was still in love with Goldwater in 1972, but somehow I saw McGovern as the one to support, compared at that point to Richard Nixon, who had promised to end the Vietnam War when he ran in 1968 and was elected president. And of course, 4 years later, the war was still going. Americans and Vietnamese were still dying. So, you know, why would I at that age support Richard Nixon, who, of course, in retrospect, I have a more nuanced view of now anyway. But the point is that these frontline experiences, if you've managed to have them, and at this period, too, at the period I started, was just an incredible time, bridging both the America when it was great, the post-war period. The greatest generation was in control in the years that I came up, in the 50s and 60s. And then it all started to turn in the late 60s with the Cultural Revolution and the Political Revolution to follow. So I've had experience in all of these, or both of these worlds. And, you know, I can look today at the primaries or the campaigns, the candidates, and of course the technology is different. A lot of things have changed, but a lot of things are the same. And you develop a sixth sense when you've hung out with these politicians close up, asked them questions, interviewed them, photographed them. This teaches you things that you're not going to learn by just accessing it online from your basement while you're sitting there in your pajamas. So I think the experience really does help me or anyone who has that similar kind of experience report and analyze today. And so, you know, the other thing I've been doing, just to briefly mention this, is I've finally started devoting the necessary time to trying to collect all of my archives, assemble and collect, which are in several far-flung locations around the country, and move them to my permanent residence so that I can deal with it. Now, these comprise thousands of videotapes, photographs, books, primary source material, and the photographs in particular. I do have most of the negatives and slides here, but I have about 60,000 black and white negatives when I used to shoot seriously. And, you know, I was a good photographer. I learned how to do photojournalism, I think, really well. You know, I really took to it. I had a dark room. I had good cameras back in the day. And, you know, like that Nixon photo speaks for itself. And I did send a few others along to Eric. I don't know if he wants to pull any of them up there. But, you know, I've got a lot of, and like 99.9% of these have never been published. So my aim is to annotate what I've got. You know, you have to organize and say, this is what it is, to digitize an example, and then to arrange for a library or a museum or someplace, a university, to take parts of this material. You know, maybe the photos here, the recordings there.
You could be an archivist for the U.S. history, what you have. I mean, 60,000, folks, think about that, 60,000 photographs.
Yeah, they're not all great by any means, but, you know, it's a large number that I have to go through. And, for example, I mentioned the McGovern campaign.
Yeah.
Well, I covered him very, very closely in 1971 and 72, including the primaries. I spent 2 weeks at the New York primary in June of 72. I went to the convention in Miami Beach. Then I covered him in the 3 weeks of the fall campaign, right up through the end in Sioux Falls when he had to concede to Richard Nixon. And I took thousands of photographs during that campaign. And I'm sure that it's a very unique archive. Not that there weren't other photographers around, but this stuff is still preserved in one place. It's in good condition. And, you know, everybody has their original view who was taking photos of these campaigns on the campaign trail, if they were professional or not. So I think a lot of it is really valuable. And I've never tried to monetize it. I've always been busy doing reporting. You know, I learned how to record very early on, meaning audio and then video, and then report. I always had some venue to report and to analyze. But now it's to save, to archive, so that if I pass away or when I pass away, this won't all just be taken to the landfill, because I've seen that actually happen to people I've known who've had incredible archives, and because they did not or were not able to make considerations for what would happen after them, it just goes to the junk pile. So I certainly don't want to see it.
No,
that happen.
Before moving on, if I can ask you, what is your most great, significant memory? I don't even know what adjective to use. Significant, greatest, most memorable moment in your career doing what you were doing. Whether it, I mean, in maybe there's more than one, but if you can select one, what would it be?
Oh, yeah, there's certainly more than one, but one that comes to mind, and it's not so much a moment, but it's moments, but they comprise kind of a breakthrough, like a eureka moment. I had done almost exclusively reporting on national politics before and during college, and then a few years afterwards. And also popular culture, too. I would write reviews of rock albums that came out or concerts, things like that for publication. But I was really, I had the political direction. And in 1974 and 75, again, 50th anniversary, I was presented with the opportunity to begin reporting on, of all things, medicine. The medical industrial complex, as I saw it, or the medical pharmaceutical complex. And this was because a war on cancer had been declared by Richard Nixon right before Christmas, 1971. It was a bipartisan legislation to pump billions into the National Cancer Institute. And that got the ball rolling towards this huge funding and disease orientation at every level. We saw it happen in the 80s with AIDS and, of course, with COVID more recently. But there was already a kind of emerging critique in the mainstream journalism, the Washington Post, the New York Daily News. Questions were being asked a few years after this boondoggle war on cancer. Saying, well, what's happening to these millions or hundreds of millions of dollars that we're suddenly pouring into this project? Nixon had promised a cancer cure in time for the bicentennial 1976, so we've certainly seen that come and go without any cure. So I started looking into that, and it didn't take me long until I became aware of the one of the early incarnations of alternative medicine. There had always been alternative cancer therapies that did not use chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery, which were always the dominant methods from the early 1900s onward, chemotherapy actually coming out of World War II poison gas program. But there were things like herbal medicine, dietary modification, the Rife microscope. There were methods that were unconventional and which were immediately labeled quackery. So when I started reporting on those, which were, again, being covered even by the mainstream media then, where Laetrol was a very popular subject. It was an alternative cancer therapy that peaked in the 1970s. And I began to discover pretty quickly that the official war on cancer was a sick joke, that the doctors I was interviewing at the National Cancer Institute or the National Institutes of Health, these were politicians. They were not real doctors or healers. And the next step was to start to investigate the alternative therapies that were around then, many of them, most of them for cancer. They were the ones that were getting the publicity. And I found a renaissance at that time in unconventional, holistic, natural healing, which I believe has never been duplicated since. And in fact, as I've monitored it since then, a lot of that thrust towards natural healing has gotten off the track and has now either been shoved into the corner or kind of mainstreamed to the extent that it's alternative medicine coaching light. It's not primary alternative medicine. So, of course, that's a long story in itself, but that then took up at least half of my professional work from the mid-70s for the next 35 years. I became, for a time, a very big fish in a very small pond, because there weren't many people who were reporting on this, again, from an open-minded, first-person experiential viewpoint of traveling throughout North America to visit alternative cancer centers, for example, in all places, Tijuana, Mexico, which in the 1970s and 80s was ground zero for credible clinics that offered alternatives to cancer, mainly for people from the United States who had been given up for lost by their doctors back home. And they made their way, some of them, to Tijuana, and a number that I reported on were healed. They were either significantly improved or they were cured. And this was like the story of a lifetime to happen across this. It took probably a few months or a short number of years until all the pieces fell together to me, especially when I was able to start traveling to visit these clinical centers. And at the time, and over the next 10 years, I got to meet, report on, and in some cases become friends with pretty much every leading light of alternative cancer medicine active in that period. People like Dr. Linus Pauling, the only person to win two unshared Nobel Prizes, who got interested in vitamin C, popularized that, created or co-created the field of orthomolecular medicine, which meant the use of tiny micronutrients to prevent illnesses or to treat illnesses. And he was clearly one of the smartest people I ever met and interviewed. Before I would interview him, which I did about a dozen times, including the last interview he ever gave before he died in 1994, I would have to prep for those interviews, because I knew that if you did not keep him interested in your interview, in your questions, in the depth of your knowledge and preparation, he had better things to do with his time. And I always really respected that. And at the most, I would try to get an hour and a half with him. But those are interviews that I have either recorded on audio tape, high-quality Dolby-i stereo audio, or videotapes. So those have to be cataloged and donated. There's a Linus Pauling Institute at a university in Oregon, so they'll probably be open to accepting that as a contribution. But it was people on that level who had made their careers in conventional science and medicine. In fact, Pauling was put on the list of the 20 most famous scientists in the history of Western medicine by a publication in England called The New Scientist. That's before he got involved with vitamin C in the 70s. So, you know, Albert St. George was another one, another Nobel Prize winner who actually discovered vitamin C in the 1930s and was given a Nobel Prize for that discovery. Well, he later turned against conventional science and medicine and had a different approach, which unfortunately he was not able to get funding for before he passed away in 1986. But I did a number of interviews and radio programs with him. So on and on it goes. But that work was documenting, was covering a life or death story. When I would go to the clinics in Tijuana, Mexico, and the three or four in particular that were really renowned and credible, and meet people who, in some cases, in many cases, were still very, very ill with cancer because they had arrived there at a late stage after surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy had failed them. And instead of just getting their affairs in order back home, they made their way to Tijuana, which was cost-effective at the time, to employ these alternative therapies. And some of them were actually doing better, and some of them I interviewed had documentary evidence that they had been cured of their cancer. But when you're talking with people who, I remember this was my first trip there in 1979, and there were four young male patients at one of the clinics that I was reporting from. And they were around my age, you know, young cancers. One of them was missing a leg because he had lost it to cancer. The other three were gravely ill. And so we'd be sitting around in this cafe, which most of the patients ate at because it was a natural foods place to eat. And when you come face to face with four young people your age who are facing death, they're looking at death, and they had the strength of character, and somehow they mobilized their lives to go to Tijuana for their last chance. After wow. After reporting that kind of thing, it really reorients your whole outlook on life and on the work that you're trying to do.
Folks, you're listening and watching Peter Barry Chowka. You can follow him at P. Chowka on X. He's just a tremendous. He's an author, writer for. why did that just escape me? American Thinker. Thank you. I can't think, but yeah, American Thinker.
AmericanThinker.com.
That's right, and a good friend. I consider him a good friend. Considering all that, you know, the time that, you know, all the times that we've spent together. And I've got to tell you, what an amazing man. So Peter, you know, here we are in 2024 with what, 20 days remaining. And you're talking about events in 79. Do you see some parallels now? Obviously you saw the, I don't know if I'd say the best, but certainly I'd say the worst of modern medicine over the last half century. Where are we at now with all this?
Just to briefly return to the COVID pandemic of 2020 to about 2023. Which we all lived through, and sometimes I have trouble just even remembering what that was like, because it was so crazy and it was so obnoxious. And I think the tendency is to just want to forget it and move on. But one of the things I did was I recorded about 4 to 6 hours a day, every day from April 2020, which was the beginning of the lockdowns, until the following summer, 2021. Recorded 4 to 6 hours a day from CNN and Fox News in order to preserve the coverage. So if I want to remind myself what it was like, I just have to put on one of those DVDs and go back in time there. But one thing I was surprised at was the disinterest of the mainstream media and even the political opposition, I guess. There wasn't much of one during COVID, but in different approaches to COVID, apart from hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, both of which were immediately ruled out as quackery or fake misinformation, which of course is not true at all, but more holistic approaches of both trying to explain and understand where COVID came from and how to maybe treat it better than the nonsense that the medical establishment was pushing, it wasn't there anymore. There were no opportunities for anybody to go into the media. Now, RFK Jr., of course, was doing his thing with his Children's Health Defense. That his work there and what they did as establishing a counter information source to the COVID madness really helped to put him on the map, including things like his biography of Anthony Fauci, which sold, I believe, 1 million copies in print, despite being blacklisted by the entire mainstream media. So
that's one of the best books I've read. I just have to say that.
Well, I should mention this just as a footnote. My experience in 2021. I was serving that year as the guest host for John B. Wells and his terrestrial radio programs, Arc Midnight and Caravan Midnight, which were syndicated on the Salem Radio Network and still are. Now, on three of those programs, because when I guest hosted, I could do the whole show. I produced it. I selected the guests. I interviewed the guests. I did my commentary. I chose the bumper music. So on three of the occasions, I chose as my guest Mary Holland, an attorney who at the time was the director of Bobby Kennedy's Children's Self-Defense, because I was following them, their work on COVID. And I knew she was probably coming from the left politically, as RFK Jr. was. But in the three interviews I did with her, comprising, I think, a total of 4 hours of airtime total, she never said one thing about anything I asked her that I disagreed with. And I thought, this is really an insight into a kind of unifying message that in the heart of this crisis, in the midst of this bizarre pandemic or plandemic, there are people from the left, people from the right, coming together to critique what was going on and maybe to agree on some important solutions. And now, of course, we see, just to fast forward, we see Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s selection as Health and Human Service Secretary, and I'll elongate on that in a moment. But that, I think, is one of the most optimistic things we can look forward to. But, you know, the melding of politics with medicine during COVID finally brought to everyone's attention, or should have, this terrible mingling of politics and medicine. I used to claim back in the 70s and 80s with my articles, and I wrote hundreds of them during those years, about the medical industrial complex, how it was power mad. And if you were unlucky enough to have cancer or heart disease, and you got in the throes of the medical establishment, very likely they were not going to help you. In fact, there were studies at the time showing that the untreated cancer patient, that is the cancer patient who said, no, I don't want the chemo, I don't want the radiation, you can keep it, that patient statistically lived longer than the patient who said, doc, give me everything you've got. But it was, you know, COVID brought this to light, this power of the political universe, the political establishment being used to kowtow to this complete evil nonsense that the medical establishment, the medical pharmaceutical establishment, was coming up with. And of course, they're still coming up with. I mean, the way they talk about RFK Jr., the way they talk about anything that is apart from the party line in medicine. But again, I think that the optimism we can maybe have, hopefully, is that as we're looking forward now, this may change. By the way, the Wall Street Journal, of all places, published an article a few days ago that I just wanted to mention and cite, if I still have it on my screen here. Yes, it was published on, December 9th. Meet the Trump nominees selling vitamins on the side. Well, from the title, you think this is going to be not a friendly look into some of the people that Trump has nominated for cabinet and other positions who may be selling vitamins on the side. But what it does is it gets into the issue with some depth and fairness and quotes a number of people who work on behalf of nutritional supplement companies, you know, representing the industry. They're not so much a representative of this or that company, but of an association that kind of represents the whole field. And these people who are involved with nutritional supplements, herbal supplements, etc., are excited by the election of Donald Trump, because they point out that he, the Republicans, and in particular, these people who he is appointing, including RFK Jr., but not limited to RFK Jr., are wide open to a complete transformation of the medical industrial complex to allopathic medicine and to a friendly, more hands-off look at nutritional supplements. Now, even though supplements are not as regulated as they could be, and as many Democrats, for example, Senator Dick Durbin, would want them to be, they are still fairly unregulated, although the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, can and has crack down on supplements or approaches they don't like and on clinicians they don't like. So anybody who's practicing the arts of alternative medicine, nutritional medicine, unconventional medicine, credibly, still has to be very, very careful, and they might wind up at the wrong end of a government investigation or even government prosecution. I mean, I could cite numerous examples, but this kind of thing still goes on. But the supplement companies now are thinking, wow, we finally may be over the hump here, and let's get some fairness into this government regulation, if not scale back the regulation totally. So that's something positive that's coming out of that. And perhaps the madness of COVID helped to set the stage of this, because it's really hard to tell, in my opinion, why Trump won in 2024. I think in 2016, I would be of the opinion that he won because he was a new face. People knew him from The Apprentice, from TV. He didn't have all the baggage that had yet been attached to him by the mainstream media and the left, which would come during his first administration. And people just couldn't stomach Hillary Clinton. They couldn't make that sale. And I think to some extent you could make that argument in this case, too, that Kamala Harris was simply an individual who was not ready for prime time, nor will she ever be. And they just couldn't shove her down our throats, notwithstanding the $1.5 billion they apparently spent in trying. And of course, people also remembered not only the superior economy under President Trump in his first term, but they probably also knew instinctively that he was not the one to push draconian mandates during COVID. I mean, he had announced, even when he was pushing or promoting Operation Warp Speed, the vaccine, before he left office, and that got approval, I believe, in December of 2020, he said he would never mandate it. The choice would be up to individual Americans. Well, of course, the first thing Biden came in his administration, I mean, they couldn't mandate it for everybody, but they certainly influenced businesses, the military, government workers to get the vaccine or else. So it was, I'm sure that in the long run, people remember that as well. So a number of positive things have arisen out of this failed transformation that Obama and then Biden promised and went very far ahead with establishing until they were checkmated by the election November 5th this year, thank God. In many ways, too, I think it was divine intervention. Like, this was our last shot. If we did not have a reprieve from four more years of the Democrats, we really wouldn't have a country left anymore. It's as simple as that.
Man, I so agree with you. And I can almost see. Yeah, and look, I truly believe God's hand was in all of this. But I can see that maybe we had to experience 4 years of Joe Biden, 4 years of the left, 4 years of this insanity, 4 years of an empty suit, 4 years of the deep state. But the exposure that was a consequence of that, man, I can, I think that we're lucky now to have gone through that so we can see how bad things were compared to how good things are going to be. My guest, of course, is Peter Barry Ciocca, a great friend of the program, good friend of mine. I'm going to tell you something. I truly am excited to have him on the show tonight. I appreciate his gracious gift of time, him and his feline companions, I will say that. And folks, if you haven't done so, please follow him on Twitter. I want to just, I have to take just a quick break here, folks. I want to talk about this little device I've got. I didn't bring it with me because obviously it's in my house. StayWarmNow.com. That's the website to go to. StayWarmNow.com. Right now you get up to 60% off. You click on the link. Look, this winter, it's cold already. It's cold outside. Baby, it's cold outside. Remember that song? We should be singing that song right now, even though it's falling out of favor. But, hey, Experts say that homeowners can expect double-digit increases in their heating bills. Prices for home heating are expected to rise as high as 10.5%. All of this adds unnecessary stress to us as homeowners, as people living in our places. And we're trying to make ends meet, and it's really difficult when the prices are that high, which is why I use this new mini space heater. You see it on your screen in my home, and I absolutely love how quickly it makes my home, the room I'm in, my bedroom, my office, and yes, even sometimes I bring it to the studio without raising my heating bills. This portable mini heater makes nearly any room warm and cozy in no time. It's compact but strong enough to warm up any room, any place you're at, and it includes a built-in overheat type of feature protection. It doesn't overheat, and if it does, it'll handle it, and adjustable heat levels from gentle warmth to blast furnace, pajamas on fire. I'm kidding, of course, but to a toasty comfort. Do yourself a favor, grab one of these up to 60% off this holiday season only at staywarmnow.com, staywarmnow.com. Plus, order today, you'll get free expedited shipping, a 60-day satisfaction guarantee, and several other free bonuses. Once again, that's staywarmnow.com. Give the gift of warmth this holiday season. Do that today, folks. It's a good little device, I'm telling you. Again, my guest is Peter Barry-Chalka. Go to follow him at PChalka on X or Twitter. Peter, thanks again for joining me tonight. And I appreciate all you do. And I appreciate all of your experience, all of your, I'll tell you, folks, we got to keep him back on, or get him back on all the time, because he's got so much background on so many things. But right before the break, you were talking about the COVID-19 and, of course, the election. What are your thoughts right now with respect to the election and COVID-19, or the response to COVID? Do you think that President Trump is going to, and his cabinet picks, are going to stop sending the strongly worded letters and finally do something about these crooks, that the people that have crushed the crushed the healthcare system, or killed people basically by keeping ivermectin, keeping the initial treatments away? I mean, are we going to see any positive changes from what we saw?
Well, here's what we can say so far, Doug, sitting just over a month from President Trump being sworn in. He and some of his appointees nominated and some of his surrogates have said that transparency is going to be the watchword when they take power on January 20th, that his appointees and the people that they appoint to help them are going to be going through the records of these agencies, including the health agencies, and to see what's really going on. The FBI, of course, it's another one that Kash Patel wants to clean out. And if they can shine the light on the records, the documents, most of which probably still exist, kind of like what Musk did when he took over Twitter. And he had several journalists come in and go through the records of how Twitter collaborated, conspired with the government to suppress certain points of view earlier in the history, key points in the history of Twitter. And that was all brought to the fore, although, of course, it didn't get as much attention as it would be if the new administration is doing a similar thing with the agencies. And clearly, anyone who's ever reported on any subject that has involved government involvement in these areas, whether it's medicine, the environment, climate change, you mentioned the two drugs which were poo-pooed by the establishment, ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. You realize very quickly on, if you have an open mind and you're smart enough to figure which end is up, you could see that the government has done their best to cover up, to obfuscate, to rip off and to harm the American people. I mean, Ronald Reagan said that very eloquently 50 years ago in his famous comment about the words to fear are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you. I mean, there's a lot of truth in that. In every area that I've covered in my career, whether it's the environment, clean air, pollution, the light bulb issue, is the government doing anything based on real science? Are they following the science? No. Big fat no. So if that kind of stuff can just be brought out into the open and there's enough media left to actually report on it, maybe we'll get somewhere. By the way, the media, let me just say in passing, because that would be a show of its own, but it's been really fascinating to watch what the mainstream media has been doing this entire year. Of course, leading up to the election, we saw 90% or more of the mainstream media. The only exception really was Fox News. 90% or more was anti-Trump and was doing every story to expose supposedly something in his background that we should be concerned about, up to and including calling him another Hitler or a fascist, or he would be, this would be the last election ever if he's elected. Now, after he was elected and won the popular vote to boot, this has softened to an extent. And you have papers like the Los Angeles Times, the publisher there, saying on the record that he's going to start incorporating more conservative viewpoints. They had the letter that Jeff Bezos wrote as an op-ed, but addressed to the Washington Post, which he owns, kind of a mea culpa, taking responsibility for their one-sided coverage. I mean, I read that letter. I couldn't believe he wrote it. You know, if he's true to that model and they actually get their act together to report fairly and objectively, or more fairly and objectively, which wouldn't be hard since they're starting from ground zero on that, that could be a breakthrough. And I mean, we'll see. But, you know, we can hope for that. We can press for that. And meanwhile, another thing that this election confirmed, I think, is that it harkens the end of what we've known as broadcasting. Now, broadcasting has been the key term since, about 100 years ago when radio started in 1920. And then television in the late 40s. It was broadcasting. It was to the broad population, the three network channels or the radio networks or the mainstream. Now, there were always some alternatives in terms of alternative print publications and whatever. But the internet, of course, has taken now 30 years to really bring this to what looks like a dominant position. I mean, what was one of the most important things that helped President Trump? His interview with Joe Rogan, who has, 140 million followers, which now not every one of those listened to his interview with Trump, but a lot of them did. And you have the decrease in audience and importance of the broadcast networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox Broadcast, and PBS. You have the cratering of the ratings for MSNBC and CNN. By the way, Fox News is the exception in that. I know a lot of folks on the conservative right, and I hear this whenever I write something for American Thinker that quotes Fox News or mentions an interview that Trump gave there, and they'll say, why are you still watching Fox News? They've gone left. You know, they're run by the communist Rupert Murdoch. Well, while I'm not a 100% fan of Fox News, I mean, nothing would please me 100%. I don't know what these people are talking about, because Fox News was the place Trump went for every interview prior to the election. They broadcast many of his rallies. All of his surrogates were on there. And Brett Baer, the news person's, the news anchor's interview with Kamala when she finally went on there was a disaster. It was the first time she ever had any questions that were not softball. So Fox News on the whole has been a great benefit. And without them, I don't think Trump would have been elected in 2016. And there's a good chance he wouldn't have been elected now either. And he's using it as the platform for it's like the Republican National Committee propaganda arm. I say that in a positive way because they need it because they're not getting any help from the rest of the mainstream media. But so the mainstream media is going down. And I think the new broad casting is going to be comprised of podcasts, not only Joe Rogan's, but the hundreds or thousands of others that are out there, by the alternative publications online, like American Thinker and many, many others. Breitbart, of course, is a lot of famous ones and a lot of up-and-coming ones. And it's a wide-open field now that it is actually having political currency. And I was concerned before this year's election, before November 5th, because, of course, I followed the campaign very, very closely, and I tried to watch as many of Trump's rallies as I could and all of his interviews. And I thought, quite frankly, that he was not making the best use of the opportunities that he did have to really express what his campaign was all about. I mean, he was famous for veering off of the teleprompter and turning a 20 or 30 minute speech into an hour and a half rambling discourse, which certainly pleased his audiences at his rallies. You know, he knew how to play to them. But I was really concerned that he wasn't broadening the appeal. Well, I guess he did, because his using these alternative media like the Joe Rogan show and others that he did clearly reached people who otherwise were not susceptible to the mainstream media. So he ultimately knew what he was doing. But, you know, I often thought as I was watching or listening to Trump's surrogates like Victor Davis Hanson or Mark Levin, they would take 2 or 3 minutes here and there to summarize why you've got to vote for Trump. You know, here's what he will do. Here's what he did do. Here's what he will do again. I thought, wow, if only Trump could do that, you know, as succinctly and as articulately. Not to say he's not articulate, but he certainly is not succinct, but he pulled it off. So there's more power to the winner there. Oh, can I just interject briefly? During the break, I scrolled through some of the comments on Rumble. I always like to read those. And one person said, enough of the cats already. Can we get to the news? But another person, said, where's Biggie and Lulu? And I was touched that somebody remembered Lulu. So in case you missed it at the beginning, Miss Lulu passed away on September 30th, 2023, at the age of, she just turned 13. And Biggie made an appearance here earlier at the start of the show. So if you really want to see Biggie and the new member of the household, Lola, they appeared at the beginning. So that will be archived, I'm sure, at Rumble. I can go back and look at that. But that,
our BFFs, best furry friends, are a big part of our sanity. So
totally.
You know, lay off, people.
Totally. Well, I can appreciate that. You know, I was going on a bit long-winded there. But no, it's, I mean, let's face it, the last 4 years have been a bummer. I mean, this, you know, in my 60 years of paying very close attention to national politics, and there have been some real ups and downs during that 60 years, as you can remember, Doug. The last 4 years, it just seemed like every day had a dark cloud hanging over it, and you could not fully enjoy whatever else you were trying to do because you're waiting for the other shoe to drop from the Biden Harris Obama version 2.0 administration regime to drop. And again, the release we felt on the night of November 5th, I mean, here in the Pacific time zone, the election began to be called for Trump by, I think it was 10:45 p.m. election night. Now, prior to that, all the poobahs in the media were saying, we may have to wait days or even weeks before we know the results. Well, it was all over not that long after the polls closed. Incredible. And it was such a shock that it was not only a victory, but this big a victory, that it took kind of a while, a few days, to really get used to this, to that cloud really had been lifted and we could focus on the future and on making America great again. Thank God.
Amen to that. I am full of optimism, but I'm are you concerned about the time period from now until the inauguration and then the time around the inauguration? It just seems to me that I don't know, maybe I'm a pessimist. Not maybe, my wife calls me that, but I just feel like there's something hanging in the background here that we're not seeing. What do you think about that?
No, that's the other side of the coin that I think is relevant, and I agree with you there. We have had such a conditioning and a control of every aspect of our lives when you think about it, right? For the last 40, 50, 60 years, and in particular, the last 16 years since Obama took power, that it doesn't change overnight. It doesn't get washed away. You still have these insidious influences at every level of our society. Academia, that's ground zero of it, where a lot of it starts. The training of people who will soon be moving into the professions and into positions of power to lead this country. And they've been brainwashed for a number of years now, but in particular, I would argue the last 16 years. And we've seen the results of that, the demonstrations this past fall or spring, and to an extent this fall, the hatred of Jews and Israel, the anti-Semitism, and who would have thought that would ever rear its ugly head here? So we have academia that's not going to change overnight. We have the mainstream media, which, as I said, although it's making some noises here and there about reporting more fairly and objectively, that's also going to be an uphill battle. We have Hollywood and popular entertainment. I continually study and reflect on, the comment inspired partly by the comment of Breitbart, the late Andrew Breitbart, that politics is downstream of culture. Now, he was not the first one to say that or to really express it, but his succinct expression of it really nails it. And I lived through that whole period, the 60s, the early 60s, the difference from the early 60s to the late 60s, when the left-wing cultural revolution rot started to entrench itself into movies, television, music, and just look around today at all of those media, those genres, and see what we've got. I mean, for example, the Grammy Awards that took place in February of 2023, and I wrote a tweet about that, which was read by Bo Snerdly, James Golden, Rush Limbaugh's producer. He invited me on his show in New York radio to talk about it because the three-hour-plus Grammy Awards, they claimed, was on the 50th anniversary of the creation of rap and hip-hop. And this celebrated the fact, this Grammy Awards broadcast, which used to include music of all forms, classical, mainstream pop, crooners like Frank Sinatra, rock and roll, country, etc., was now narrowed down to basically rap and hip-hop. And this broadcast was one of the most disgusting displays of the debasement of our culture, American popular music, that I could ever imagine. It was just horrendous. So you have that kind of thing that's there that has to be loosened up or opened up. All of these celebrities who people follow, I'm always amazed when I see that someone like Taylor Swift has over 100 million followers, I think, on Instagram or X or, you know.
Yeah, it's bizarre. I don't know.
It is. And I mean, in my opinion, she is a manufactured item. When you bring together that kind of money and power and production values, and this is what you get at a cost of what, about $1,000 a ticket, if you're lucky, it's obscene.
It really is. And you're right to bring this up. As you mentioned Breitbart, you know, politics is downstream from culture. Our culture today is really, it's demonic at best. So,
you know, when I was doing the Wells Show guest hosting on one of the shows, I interviewed one of my favorite people in media, Norm N. Knight, N-I-T-E. He goes by that name. It's a stage name, also Mr. Music. He literally wrote the encyclopedias of rock and roll starting in the 1970s, and he's even better known as being one of the top presenters of rock and popular music on radio in the number one market, New York City. Yep. And I happened to be introduced to his work on New York radio in the mid-1980s, and I have about 120 cassettes that I recorded of his shows, his radio shows, and on CBS FM, an oldies station. It was like an education, a postgraduate education in American popular music from a truly brilliant man. And I got the chance to interview him. He's going to be 84 next month. So I interviewed him on the phone, and great interview, but great interviewee. And I asked him, I said, you know, it seems to me that music in the day that we were talking about, which is like the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, even pop music, rock music, were much more diverse than anything we see now, especially when you have like the Grammys institutionalizing rap as it. That's it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And he took it even further. And I also said, you know, I have the memory, having lived through that period, that especially once we hit the 60s, the mid-60s, before the Cultural Revolution, that the music, the rock and roll music, the popular music, was bringing together everyone, including the races, because you had black artists, you had white artists who were doing songs that wound up on the top 10 or the top 40. Their color didn't matter. They made great music. You had, for example, Motown or Stax Volt artists, along with the Beatles and the British Invasion and everybody else who was recording then. And he took it even further and said that when he was starting his career in the 60s in music as a music presenter, more than a DJ, he was a presenter, that it was the most diverse period of American music ever. And I realized that myself, because one of the things I like to do is go back and look at the charts of what hits were on the Billboard Hot 100. That list started in 1958, and it's been published every week since then, and it's all online. You can go back and look. What were the top 100 hits of this day in 1964 or 1984 or whenever? And my God, in the 60s, almost any week in the 60s, you look at the top 100, or especially the top 40, and I would say easily more than half of those songs you can remember if you were alive then, and they were great, great songs. You know, they stood the test of time. You can listen to them today, and I still do, and they are certifiably great. And can you say that about the music, quote-unquote, that's around today?
Oh, Peter, you know, I would love to. And people who are listening right now might be thinking, well, what is really, what, so what? No, I mean, this speaks to, again, the culture, the debasement of the culture that we in the West, especially in America, have experienced. I mean, the West encompasses, obviously, all English or Anglo-Saxon and English-speaking people. But, man, you know, you go back and it's like anything else. I talk about, you know, the times when you dressed up to get on a plane, you mm-hmm. dressed up to go to a church, you had respect, there was respect. Now there's anything but out there. I mean, it seems like half the people belong in mental institutions. So, Peter, all of this, you know, you're 100% right. And when we look at things happening today, you know, I really believe that we have gone so far. The left, specifically the left, the immoral left, has taken us to the place where we're at today. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, you can. I mean, the not only for entertainment, but for serious study, I look at the culture that we had when America was great. And when I hosted the Wells programs, and I could choose the bumper music in and out of commercials and top of the hour, bottom of the hour breaks. So there were 24 songs that I could choose to play little snippets of, you know, as bumper music. And I pretty much chose music from the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And I would talk a little bit about them. And I'd say, you know, this was music when America was great, because I think America was definably, undeniably great until probably 1992, I would say, when Clinton was elected, and the downhill slide really started beginning then. But it's, you know, the television we watch most of the time here when we've taken a moment to eat dinner on our TV trays and put something on, it's not some crap from today. It's some classic TV or film from the past. And almost all of it is available now if you know where to find it, or you can find it on DVDs, or you can find it on eBay, even on VHS tapes. Plus, I've recorded a lot of it along the way. And it's this window into the America of the recent past that I remember, that I lived through. But of course, my memory is refreshed by going back there and looking at some of these programs and films and discovering new ones as well. It's just an endless process. And it's not that I'm a Luddite or I'm not interested in the culture of today, but whenever I delve into it, when I dip my toe into it, a film, somebody says, oh, you got to see this movie. And when it finally comes on cable or something, I'll check it out. Chances are it just really leaves me cold. Or the music. When you scan the FM dial of the radio now, no matter where you are in the country, I'm sorry, it's terrible. It all sounds the same. It's all infused with this rap, hip-hop nonsense, unless it's a country station. But even country music has changed a tremendous amount. Whereas when I was growing up with an earshot of New York City radio and television, thank God, in a suburb of New York, I could scan the FM dial on my radio and hear classical stations, pop stations, you know, like middle of the road, they would call it, like Frank Sinatra or orchestral music, or, you know, rock, folk music, black music, ethnic music. Now that's all gone. It's all gone in favor of like Taylor Swift and hip hop and rap. And there's just nothing there. I mean, I can't find a station that I want to listen to. And I'm interested in music. I love music. I always have. That, along with politics, was my first love. I bought my first 45 RPM record when I was 6 years old. So I've followed music my whole life. But it just, and I mean, classical music, for example, the house I grew up in, my parents were not into classical music. They didn't have any classical records. And I discovered classical on the radio, and not that it became my number one go-to station, but it helped to inform me that there was this culture out there. And eventually, when I got to Washington, D.C., where I went to college, the Kennedy Center was there, the Library of Congress was there, which put on classical concerts either free or for 50 cents. So I would go to those, learn to appreciate that. It has to start somewhere. It starts when you're young. And now if you're young and you can't even find this stuff anymore. I mean, classical, I don't think classical CDs are made anymore, are they? I mean, CDs themselves are disappearing now. In fact, you're not supposed to own your own music anymore or record it. Recording devices are very hard to come by now. You can't buy tape recorders anymore, or yes, you can buy little digital recorders, but it's not the same. Good luck making a mixtape on that. And, you know, I love to record television programs. I got my first VHS recorder in 1979, and I have literally thousands of VHS tapes in storage of everything under the sun that I recorded until DVDs came out, when I could record on them. Well, now they've discontinued, of course, all VHS machines. You can't even find something to play the tapes back on. And these devices that for about two decades you could record digitally and then burn your recording to a disc, so you would have a permanent archive. The last one was manufactured in 2017 or 2018. So they are rapidly going out too. Now that, you know, if you go to Amazon and they say, oh, do you want to buy this movie? Okay, yeah, I want to buy this movie. You're not actually buying a copy of this movie. You're kind of renting it from its place where it sits in the cloud. And you have to log on and go through a password and enable your device every time you want to watch that movie or that program that you supposedly bought and own.
Right.
So this is a subtle way of conditioning us again, like the whole world of streaming. You don't need to own a production, a program, a movie. Just stream it. Well, is that stream going to be there forever? Of course not, especially if wokeness takes hold. I mean, you can't find any of the Charlie Chan classic films available for streaming. Good luck with that, right? Some of the most interesting films made of all time in the 1930s and 40s, Charlie Chan, gone. This is one small example, but you can see that coming down in the future when the powers that be. I mean, do you trust Jeff Bezos in making available the complete library of everything at Amazon for an affordable price? Of course not.
Oh, heck no.
In fact, lately, I've been doing more shopping on eBay. I find that you can find stuff for better prices if you know how to shop eBay. Some of it new, sealed, and mint condition than at Amazon, plus a lot of old stuff that otherwise you're not going to find at all. So thumbs down on Amazon.
Again, you know, we're talking about culture. And I think a lot of people, you know, the people will focus on news, which is fine, as well we should. But the underlying problems that we're facing today has a lot to do with exactly what you're talking about. And that's the culture of our society. I mean, so again, you know, people have lost respect for themselves. They've lost respect for others. Everything has changed, and especially over the last, really the last 50, 60 years. And I would say too that the, without getting too far into this, but I believe that, you know, a lot of the goal of the intelligence agencies, communities, and such are conditioning us to be a lot, along with people, along with the food and water, a lot more stupid. That's just, they're dumbing us down. And you know, by the great, well, the
that's
average,
absolute true. Just, I mentioned classical music. Studies showed that if you listen to classical music, not all the time, but just even some of the time, it helps your levels of cognition. It helps your intelligence, your focus. It's good for you.
Yes.
And look at what we're listening to now.
Yes.
Most people. It's garbage.
Yeah.
And it's bad.
It's filthy. You know, the hip hop stuff, it's violent, it's filthy, it's pornographic.
Now, we're surprised that people like Diddy and that other character now who's being accused.
Jay-Z,
I mean, these
or
people
something.
Made billions on rap and hip hop. What do you expect them to be?
Exactly.
That quote, art, I use the term loosely, unquote, is reflected in their lives.
Yeah. Yeah, it's horrific.
It's a downhill slide, and you know, hopefully we can begin. We have to take some baby steps here, but we have to begin to reverse this. And I think we do have a chance now with this new administration. You know, I am encouraged. Oh, well, one thing I am. You asked if I'm concerned either between the period now and the inauguration, or certainly after it. Yes, I'm concerned every day. Every day I wake up and immediately check the news online. I hope something horrendous didn't happen. But look at this bizarre shooting a week ago in New York, and this character who has been alleged, charged with killing the health insurance executive, now has tremendous numbers of fans on the internet. Now, I compare this to the period when the Unabomber was captured on April 4th, 1996. Now, in 1996, early 96, that was really the first year of the internet. The Netscape browser came out in the winter of 94, 95. It was slow to catch on. People were still You know, computers were expensive. I think something like fewer than 5% of people were online on the internet in early 1996. So it was not a factor. And was there a fan club online for Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber? No. Everybody agreed this guy was a monster, and he was convicted and sent to prison, where he died by suicide last year after he was diagnosed with cancer. Now, you contrast this individual, which I wonder if this is some kind of psyop, if not at the cause of it, but now jumping onto it and taking advantage of people's distaste for what they think is the medicine they're getting because of the insurance companies, and they are being programmed to want to call for socialized mandated health care, a la Hillary Care of 1993, an expansion of like Obamacare of 2010 or 2010. And these things, you know, scare me to death, because I've spent endless amounts of time researching socialized medicine, mandated medicine, the British medical system. I mean, when I was here in 2017 doing shows, we were covering the case of Charlie Gard, the baby who the National Health Service in England pulled the plug on him, even though a doctor in the United States said he might be able to save this child. So if that's what you want, if you want death medicine, then vote for socialized medicine, because that's what you're going to get. But the media, the Democrat politicians, and these lunatics online who are using social media now because they can anonymously do it, are all cheering on the death of this individual who directed that insurance company, and saying, well, there's plenty more angry people out there because we need socialized medicine. CNN, while they're not going exactly down that road, they're having all these, quote, experts on, all of them with an axe to grind and money to make from Medicine Inc., saying we have to have the government pay for it so everybody's guaranteed health care. Right.
You know, you mentioned that. That's, look, that from beginning to end, that whole thing, that shooting, along with the suspect, how he was identified, how he was captured, the different, and folks, I'm aware of the different photographs online. You know, there's a lot wrong to me. Okay. I have a lot of questions about this. And also the, if you watch Nancy Pelosi, her actions, trades, you know, shorts and calls and things before this shooting, I'm telling you something. Look, I know homicides happen. Okay. They do. And I know people lose it and snap and kill people. I got that. But I just think that there's more to this. And this is going to be a gift that keeps on giving. And I use that, in quotation marks, I guess, but socialized medicine, gun control, you know, hey, we have to ban suppressors, just on and on. So go ahead. I mean, I think there's a lot wrong with that.
Absolutely. And so that came out of nowhere last week. And I agree with you that all of this doesn't add up. I mean, so many of these events, the two assassination attempts on Donald Trump this year, don't add up either. Right. And one of them we've hardly heard anything about, the one who was supposedly or was killed by the sniper, but where's all the information? There's a committee studying this. Are we ever going to get to the transparency of that? So, yeah, we have to hold tight and pray and hope that we get to January 20th and Donald Trump is protected. I mean, I wonder if the fact that he's been keeping a low profile relatively since the election, he's been ensconced there at Mar-a-Lago, working hard to assemble his team, yeah. And he's done that very, very quickly and effectively, no matter what you think of all of his nominees, that maybe he's being cautious. You know, when he finally takes control and is in charge of the Secret Service with his people there, maybe he'll feel more confident, although I think they'd really have a lot of nerve to let anything happen to him now at this point. But
well, all I can say is, you know, there are a lot of, I'll say this about the J-13, the Butler attempt, the attempt, and of course, mm-hmm. Thomas Matthew Crooks dead on the roof. You know, as a platform, 35 years in the investigative business, of course. I don't know if I talked to you about this, Peter, but I was contacted, I did an investigation close to about 300 man hours on the ground interviewing people. But I'm going to tell you something, all right? We have some information we have not let loose yet. The reason being, we're going to see if, and hopefully this can come out, that there was, look, one in one septillion chance that when you take every failure at Butler and add them, you know, put them up, and there were 12 identifiable failures, mix that with a shooter, the chances of all those events happening on the same day at the same place is one in one septillion. So that's just, I'm just saying that there's a lot wrong with that. And you start asking questions, people get upset. You start asking really, you know, relevant questions, all of a sudden death threats come forward. But I digress. But yes.
You know what that reminds me of, Doug, before I forget? At the end of the 1973 film called Executive Action, which was released 10 years to the day of the JFK assassination and was co-written by Mark Lane, who wrote one of the first books questioning the JFK assassination and the cover-up, Rush to Judgment. At the end of that film, there is a crawl of text which gives the odds of all of these odd things happening to witnesses who had testimony that was never taken seriously about the assassination, and some actuary had come up with a similar number that the odds of all of these people getting bumped off or dying suspiciously was like, you know, a zillion to one. So everything like this that happens, attempted assassination, or some of these other strange events, they never seem to add up. And even if there wasn't a conspiracy at the outset to cause them, there certainly was a conspiracy in many cases to use them to then push the country, the government, the people in a certain way, thanks to PSYOP propaganda. In the closing moments, before we run out of time, since people would like news, if I could just talk a little bit about my reporting on some of the cabinet nominees. And first, briefly, RFK Jr., I've alluded to him briefly in this appearance, but as somebody who reported on innovative, alternative, unconventional medicine for 35 years, before it kind of was rechristened as complementary alternative medicine, which is a kind of a lesser way to describe it, because it means it has to complement, these alternative methods have to complement or support the mainstream medicine. No, they can stand on their own if they really are effective. But anyway, RFK Jr., I think, is the first time in the history of my paying attention to that area in 50 years that we can really see possibly some light at the end of the tunnel. Early on, my colleagues and I, in particular the late Bob DeBraga, a cancer patient who I knew, who was just really exceptional, and he and I would get together and say, he'd say, Peter, we've got to get this story of the cancer cover-up to the networks, to 60 Minutes. And then we've got to get it to the floor of the Congress. And then we'll get somewhere. Well, guess what? It got to 60 Minutes in 1980 and the other shows, 2020, et cetera, some of them I contributed to. It got to the floor of Congress, which had a study on unconventional cancer treatments where the fix was in by I forget the name of the group that studied that in the 80s. And then that landed on the floor of Congress, which ordered the National Institutes of Health to start an Office of Alternative Medicine in 1992. Well, I was part of all of those endeavors, including the creation of the NIH and serving on two of their first program advisory panels. And you know what it amounted to? Nothing. Nothing. They became like quack busters using their budgets to poo-poo conventional or rather unconventional alternative medicine and to buttress or support mainstream allopathic technological medicine as they did during COVID. So this is the first time when somebody from outside, totally outside the medical establishment, who has a career of challenging Medicine Inc., especially during and since COVID, and has come around totally to support President Trump. And the other people Trump has pointed to different positions at the NIH and the FDA and the Centers for Disease Control. It's almost too good to be true. Now, I hope it really pans out. I think we can really hope and have expectation that this is finally going to amount to something, to first get the government off our back, get this kind of nonsense of, I did a story three years ago about how the medical establishment had embraced critical race theory, and all of the leading medical journals in the world, including the United States, had come together and identified racial inequity as the major cause of ill health in the Western world. Now, what a load of complete nonsense that is, not following the science at all. They shoehorn the reality into their version of science, and then they hit the American people over the head with it through the media, and that becomes institutionalized policy. In fact, the day that Biden took office, January 20th, 2021, there was a 200-plus page document that was released that day that obviously had been in preparation for a long time before, suggesting that at every level of government, equity had to drive the bus from now on, including in the medical at the NIH, Health and Human Services, et cetera. So they were already completely corrupting science to fit into their ideological agenda. So Bobby Kennedy, I mean, God bless him. I hope that he and the people he's going to be working with can really pull it off. But if he can at least succeed in uncovering and providing transparency to everything that's going on, not only with COVID, but with the war on AIDS, with what Fauci has been up to, assembling his millions of dollars, I guess cashing in allegedly on patents that are developed at the agencies that he's serving as a paid government employee. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that finally has to come out that the media used to do back in the day, but of course they don't anymore. So now maybe it can come for the first time from within the government itself and have
Buttigieg. I mean, that's a wonderful selection, I believe.
Absolutely.
I mean, yeah, as an author of one of the authors of the Great Barrington Declaration. Mm-hmm. Okay, continue, sir.
This is almost too good to be true when you just think of that. It's like, wow, who could have predicted this? I mean, you know, Bobby Kennedy didn't endorse Trump until, I believe, July. And then it was unclear leading up to the election. Nobody in the Trump orbit would confirm a role that Bobby might have if he was elected or what. And it gives him one of the most important roles. In fact, that's arguably certainly one of the top two or three roles, the other being Defense Department and Treasury, I would argue, maybe State Department. But now on to the Defense Department. Now, I've had the opportunity to do some writing and analysis of the nomination of Pete Hegseth. Now, I was very familiar with Pete Hegseth because I do monitor Fox News a lot. And because of my schedule, I'm often have on Fox News in the background, no matter what else I'm doing, for their morning show, which airs from 6 to 9 a.m. weekdays and 6 to 10 a.m. weekends. And for the last 5 years or so, Pete Hegseth has been one of the three co-hosts on the Saturday and Sunday editions of this Fox morning show. And you can say that he is an effective morning show host. However, I was never, for whatever reason, I was never quite comfortable with the depth of his presentations or his whole shtick, if I can put it in those terms. So, however, when he was nominated as DOD secretary, I thought, well, let's give him a closer look. So I accessed the police report from Monterey, California, which was filed after he was investigated after a female alleged that he had sexually assaulted her without her permission on a night in November 2017 during a conference in Monterey, California. And this police report is very, very alarming, to say the least. And on top of that, there have been two articles that I've focused on in particular, one in The New Yorker, The Secret Life of Pete Hegseth, which was published December 1st, and another one at NBC News two or three days later, which talked about how or claimed that there were 10 sources at Fox News, both current and former, who allege that Pete Hegseth has a serious alcohol problem, which impaired his appearance, performance on the morning show, his arriving late, his being hungover, etc. Now, of course, you could say, well, all right, this is NBC News, right? And the other one is The New Yorker, which is another left-of-center publication. But the length and details in these articles, even if you subtract the ideological bent, and both of them pretty fairly written, I have to say, considering the publications, they are extremely disturbing. And Hegseth made his first appearance in an interview last night, that is Tuesday night, on Fox News on Hannity's show. Well, it was the mother of all puffball interviews. It ran for just over 6 minutes. Hegseth got just over 4 minutes. And I wanted to publish the transcript, so I did at American Thinker Today, along with my brief analysis and then a reader comment that I believe I added. And actually, that was yesterday, I guess, that I did the Hegseth article. His answering the questions, which didn't really come up, Hannity wasn't really about to ask them, but his Hegseth's obfuscation and his way of deflecting reminded me of a skillful politician and not somebody who should be running the Department of Defense. Hegseth himself admits that while he was married to his second wife and they had several kids, the marriage was still ongoing, he knocked up his friend at Fox News, impregnated her, then his second wife divorced him, and he married the former Fox News associate. Now, meanwhile, this alleged assault, which he was alleged to have committed in Monterey, occurred right around that time. So he's got a wife, a girlfriend who's pregnant, and he's accused of attempting or maybe even completing this one-night stand with a woman who didn't give her consent.
How long ago was that again?
November 2017. That's when he was already on Fox News. Oh, and plus, his lawyer paid the woman off with a non-disclosure agreement, so she can't talk about it unless he releases her, which nobody's asked him to do that, and they probably won't. I mean, I just, you know, it's like Matt Gaetz. Okay, Matt Gaetz had his fans, you know, who liked him for attorney general, but didn't Trump do a lot better when he finally went to Pam Bondi? And I think Trump could do a lot better if Pete takes himself out and Trump gets somebody in there. I mean, for one thing, Hegseth's admitted behavior as a veteran, I mean, if he was still a member of the military, he could be prosecuted because he violated the Uniform Code of Military Justice by having an adulterous affair, a child out of wedlock, and not to mention this alleged rape, which apparently, according to some of these articles, is the tip of the iceberg. Now, where there's smoke here, that much smoke, there's got to be some fire. And he's admitted some of it. So, you know, what's the problem?
Yeah. Look, so that was 7-8 years ago. Could he have changed? His behavior matured, perhaps.
Why should you take a chance on that? I mean, really, there are people. Not that we need a saint in there, but I mean, the other thing the New Yorker article points out or alleges that between his military service and admittedly he served on the front lines in Iraq and Afghanistan, then at Guantanamo, between then and Fox News, he ran two small veterans charities, you know, not very well funded. And New Yorker unearthed documents and testimony that he ran them into the ground. He used the money for his own personal use. He didn't manage. He has basically no managerial experience at all. And what does the job at the DOD entail? Managing the largest number of people in a cabinet agency, you know, well over a million of consultants and troops. And I mean,
I didn't know that. And that worries me more than the other stuff, frankly.
That's what, when I wrote this thing at American Thinker yesterday, and it got, I think, 65 reader comments, and you have to pay to comment there now, so that's a lot. And several people said that. They said, I never heard that about him. That's very concerning. That's why I link to these articles, and I said, don't take my word for it. Do some more research. I mean, Greg Kelly at Newsmax. Now, you know, Newsmax is right there with Trump. I mean, they're 100% Trump all the way. Well, Greg Kelly, on his program last week, his primetime show, came out strongly against Pete Hegseth. Trump can do better. So, I don't normally like to take an opinion, a hardcore opinion, and say, you know, I think you should vote this guy down or this person up. I just try to let the facts drive the story. But I'm very concerned here. I haven't done original reporting on it, but I've certainly scoured as much as I can find, including that police report. And when Hegseth and Hannity said last night on Fox that Hegseth had been completely exonerated by the Monterey police after their investigation, that's simply not true. That's a lie. To not be charged for something that you're alleged to have done is not the same thing as being exonerated, right? Exactly. The allegations still stand. So I want to hear about that. And if he would actually go into a forum, well, famously about a week or so ago when he first made an appearance on Capitol Hill, and he looked into the camera and he said, I'm not here to answer your question. I'm here to answer the senator's questions. In other words, you media people can go where you need to go, right? And I thought that's really insulting because we, the American public, have questions too. He goes on Fox News and does a puffball interview. That's nothing. That's nothing. He needs to sit down with Bret Baier if he wants somebody at Fox News who will actually ask him some hard questions. You know, it's...
And Peter, this is what I really like about you. It doesn't matter. You're a take-no-prisoners kind of person. You're honest. And here are the facts.
I want Trump to succeed. I want him to have the best possible people. Pam Bondi, I think, is going to be a great AG. RFK, Fox had a poll today, and they said they rated the cabinet appointments so far in a public opinion poll. And RFK Jr. had the most support of any other, potential candidate nominee for the cabinet. So he, I believe, is a good choice. Marco Rubio, they say, has a lot of foreign policy experience, and he will, he seems to be able to get confirmed as a senator. So, as we mentioned, some of the other appointments in the health care sector have been exemplary. And I think he could just do better than somebody who's carrying a lot of baggage and should go back to hosting at Fox News.
Well, I'll tell you something, folks, if you want, and I mean this with all my heart, if you really want the truth of a matter, Peter Barryczaka provides that information in an unbiased fashion. You can read his work at American Thinker. You can also find him in everything is linked by way of his website, peter.media, and he's a national, I'm telling you, he's a national treasure, and I am so honored to have him spend time with us, him and his even despite the cats. Now I'm a dog guy, but that's all right. But no, I really appreciate it. We got about a minute left.
Doug, I really appreciate your kind words and this opportunity, and yes, I would appreciate if people want to get in touch with my work in print. I've written over a million words for American Thinker in the last 17 years, over 500 articles. It's all accessible, free, no charge, if you can put up with the pop-up ads. And you can find a link there at peter.media. Or there's another one. My archive is accessible by going to tinyurl.com/PCAthinker. tinyurl.com/PCAthinker. Very easy to find. And also my Twitter, which is P-C-H-O-W-K-A, my ex-Twitter. I largely use that as a table of contents for things I'm doing, interviews,